I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Everyone knows stress is bad for you. It contributes to heart disease, stroke, insomnia, depression, and a host of other conditions. Doctors and counselors tell us to avoid stress or find ways to reduce it. But our next guest, a Stanford University psychologist, says this conventional wisdom is wrong. In a book called The Upside of Stress, Kelly McGonigal says that instead of getting rid of stress or burning out if we can't cope, we should embrace stress and channel it into positive directions. Relying on the latest research, she suggests that changing your mind about stress can transform your health, your emotions, and your entire experience of life. Kelly McGonigal will tell us why and how on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. He'll be back tomorrow. Before we get into our main topic this hour, stress, and how to make stress work for us, we want to give listeners an update about this morning's developments in the Freddie Gray murder case. Prosecutors and defense attorneys for the six Baltimore police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray appeared at a hearing on some key defense motions. Circuit Court Judge Barry Glenn Williams has denied both of the motions argued thus far, the motion to dismiss charges against the police officers and the motion asking for the recusal of State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns, P. Kenneth Burns, was in the courtroom this morning. Hey, Kenneth. Kenny?
Hi, Sheila.
Hi. Tell us how the arguments proceeded this morning.
Well, each side had 15 minutes. It started with the defense. They argued their points in regards to the dismissal of charges for prosecutorial malfeasance. In other words, the prosecutors were not exactly ethical. And then the recusal of Marilyn Mosby and the state's attorney's office. They dealt with the motion for dismissing the charges first. During that argument, the defense alleged that there were political motivations and personal motivations behind charging the six officers accused of the death of Freddie Gray, and it was back and forth. It actually got done in little more than an hour.
Both of these motions. I understand that the judge was tough on both the defense attorneys and the prosecutors.
They were. The judge was tough, particularly on the prosecutors because of what happened during the news conference announcing the charges back on May 1st. And the judge was tough on the defense for trying to get the employees of the state attorney's office as witnesses for the trial. And the judge already squashed whatever attempts that was going to be made.
I understand. I'd like to play a clip of the moment that the judge apparently referenced specifically as something that might be a matter for a grievance board. Let's hear that.
Did the officers, cooperative with your investigation?
Yes.
All six?
No. They gave a statement, and I can't get too far into the facts of this case.
Go ahead, sir.
I can't answer that.
So that was a reporter asking if the police had been cooperative and State's Attorney Mosby saying she couldn't get into it. Kenny, did the judge indicate why he finds that problematic?
He found it problematic because it revealed some of the evidence in the case in a public setting. It dealt with a couple of professional conduct rules among state lawyers. And so just those six lines, the judge found it problematic that she even said that much. And he believed that the prosecutors, Michael Schatzow, argued the case for both motions for the prosecution. He believed that you just can't dismiss it, but at the same time, it doesn't rise to the level of misconduct or recusal. In addition, he said a lot of the arguments that the the defense had brought up is not a case. Well, first of all, he doesn't have the jurisdiction to issue sanctions against the prosecutors because he doesn't have that jurisdiction. But ultimately, he said it's a matter for the grievance committee to sort out.
We heard NPR's Jennifer Ludden reporting on the national news at the top of this hour, so we know NPR is there in the courtroom. Set the scene for us. Who else is in the courtroom?
Well, you have all your local media, including us. You also have national outlets. You also have both the major wire services, Reuters and AP. You also have, it was pretty much a full courtroom. You also had Tess Hill Ashton, who's president of the local NAACP chapter, and a number of people that I've seen from time to time at protests calling for police accountability. But it has definitely captured the national attention from not just for radio, television, as well as wire services.
And I understand Judge Williams has said he will reconvene at 2 p.m. What will be before him then?
They are going to decide whether or not whether the cases will be tried together, meaning all six of the officers will be tried together, or they will be tried individually, or if they're going to be kind of subgroups between like a 2-4 combination, for example. And that mostly has to do with the charges that each of the officers face and the seriousness of the charges.
So that will be argued this afternoon. Are we expecting that Judge Williams will also rule from the bench on that motion, or do we know?
It's hard to say. It was really hard to say if he was going to rule this morning, but he said that after the arguments were made, everyone was going to reconvene, and he issued his decision. It depends on how quickly he's able to look at the law and go off of that.
Kenny, I thank you for your reporting, and I'm sure you're going to be reporting more as the day unfolds. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
We're going to take a break now on Midday. Before we do that, when we come back, we're going to be talking about stress, and you can be part of that conversation. And you can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can email us at midday@wypr.org. We'll be back in a bit. Thanks. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cass, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. We all live with stress. Stress from our jobs, from long hours, office politics, or abusive bosses. Stress from trying to balance work with the needs of our spouses and our kids. Stress from shaky relationships or teenage children. Stress from illness or caring for an elderly parent. When we get too stressed out, our health can suffer. Heart attacks, stomach problems, excessive drinking, nervous disorders, more common among people who have difficulty handling the stress in their lives. As a result, for decades, psychologists and counselors have told us to reduce the stress in our lives, to avoid situations that cause stress. But our guest in this hour argues that we're looking at stress the wrong way. Kelly McGonigal, a Stanford University psychologist, says that instead of trying to escape it, we can embrace the stress in our lives, use it as a source of excitement and energy, and channel it in positive directions to improve our emotional and physical health. Her new book is The Upside of Stress: Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. She cites recent research showing that telling people about the positive aspects of stress can help many of them feel better and function better. In the case of some professors, such as law enforcement or firefighting, professions such as law enforcement or firefighting, avoiding stress can be dangerous, as high stress can improve performance and safety. The key, McGonigal argues, is the correlation between resilience, the human capacity for stress-related growth, and mindset, which is the power of belief to shape reality. Her book offers suggestions for cultivating a mindset to embrace stress, to channel it into new focus and energy. It also explains how the brain is built to learn from stress, how it can help people connect, develop empathy, strengthen relationships. Kelly McGonigal is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University, a yoga and fitness instructor, and a proponent of what she calls science help. She gave a TED Talk in June 2013 called How to Make Stress Your Friend. Kelly McGonigal is on the line with us. Her book, The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It, is available from Avery Books, which is a Random House imprint. Kelly McGonigal, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thank you for sticking with us while we reported some of the news today in Baltimore. Before we get go into why stress can be good for us, let's talk about what stress means. I mean, people constantly talk about feeling stressed out or being under a lot of stress, but as a psychologist, how do you define stress?
Yeah, it's funny, right? We use the word stress to describe so many things. We use the word stress to describe life circumstances. We use stress to describe our inner experiences, like feelings and emotions. And sometimes we just use the word to describe anything it is that we wish were not true, you know, and we just call all of that stress. And the way that I think about stress is that stress is what happens in your brain and in your body when something that you care about is at stake. And I listen to you describe all the things that stress people out: caring for a loved one, parenting, work, worrying about one's own health. And I think those are really good examples that we have a stress response because our brains and our bodies, they want to help us rise to the challenge, focus on what matters. And we have this cascade of changes, biological changes, emotional changes that are really there to help us meet whatever life is asking of us. And that's how I define stress. And I think that's more helpful than the way that we often talk about stress as if we're just a victim of stress in our lives.
I should tell listeners, if you want to be part of this conversation about stress, we'd like to have you be part of it. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or toll free at 1-866-661-9390. You can also join our conversation by email if you email us at midday@wypr.org. So you're saying, Kelly, that stress is shows up when we care about something.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we wouldn't have a stress response if we didn't care. And another thing that goes along with that some part of you has to believe that there's something you can do in this moment to respond. Otherwise, we don't have a stress response. We may be paralyzed. We may have a defeat response, which is a lot like depression, where we give up. And a stress response, even though we may not like how it feels, whether we're worrying and anxious or whether we're angry and tense, that we're having that response because some part of us thinks not only is something that I care about at stake, but I need to do something. I need to connect. I need to ask for help. I need to make a change. I need to take an action. And I think that this sort of understanding of what stress is sort of the beginning of understanding why it is that stress actually is helpful, and trying to escape or avoid or reduce stress can actually get in the way of responding to life and all the challenges we face.
Well, let me make sure I understand, because it seems to me that a lot of times we feel stressed when we don't have a sense of any control, when we feel locked in or pushed to do something that troubles us. Are you saying that even though we commonly call those lack of control situations stress, that's not really stress? That's something else?
Well, certainly situations that we feel like we can't control to our satisfaction can give rise to a stress response. But what's important to understand is that even in those situations that you can't control, maybe the outcome, you know, you can't make your loved one not be dealing with a health crisis, you can't change necessarily how your boss is acting at work, that doesn't mean that you don't have control over something. And part of our stress response is there to prompt all sorts of responses that are useful to you in that moment. You know, part of your stress response, and I know we can talk about this in more detail later, but part of your stress response is to create a biology of wanting to connect with others, of wanting to experience social closeness or social support. And that's something that you can choose even when you can't control a situation. Part of your stress response may be to motivate courageous risk-taking, where you don't know if you can control the outcome, but it's worth doing something to try to see what you can change or see what you can make happen. And that's part of what's happening in the stress response. And truly, the opposite of a stress response is depression, collapse, defeat. And sometimes I think people label that stress because it feels awful. And we might think of the situations that trigger it as stressful. But I think it's really important to make that distinction, that being stressed out is not the same thing as being depressed or being paralyzed. That if you're feeling stressed out, that means you have resources and there are opportunities.
Your book, The Upside of Stress, runs counter to the conventional wisdom that stress is bad for us. Why have people believed that for so long?
Yeah, well, we've all been told that, right? And I think that the best origin for our current mindset towards stress is from research that was done actually in the 1930s in Canada by an endocrinologist named Hans Selye. And he was having a great old time in the laboratory injecting rats with what he called noxious agents. You know, it could be hormones, it could be toxins and poisons. And he found that if you gave rats enough of a noxious agent, you could basically make any rat sick, shrivel up their immune system, and then eventually they would die. And he found that you could create that same effect by doing other awful things to rats, like partially severing their spinal cord or exposing them to extreme temperatures. And any way that he tortured rats, he was able to make them sick and eventually kill them off. And what's so fascinating is he decided to call what he was doing to rats and what happened to their bodies as they basically wore out from this noxious exposure. He called that stress. And he decided that it was a really good metaphor or analogy for human life. And he went on world tours talking about stress and claiming that the experience of just being human, having to adapt to life and all of its challenges, that was the same as what he was doing to rats in his laboratory. And he never studied humans, which is what's so interesting. There are big differences between being a human who's stressed out and being a laboratory rat who's tortured. And yet he basically spread this message that stress is toxic and that life is stress. In fact, he defined stress as anything that requires us to adapt, act, or change. And if you think that the inevitable consequence of having to act, adapt, or change, basically life, is to end up like his rats, then we're going to fear stress and we're going to fear life. And even now when you hear about how stress can be harmful, most of the studies that you're hearing about are conducted in laboratories with animals in situations that I think are more likely to be good analogies for extreme human suffering and not the kind of stress most of us deal with, stress that is connected in some way to the meaning in our lives, whether it's relationships or parenting or work. And I think it's certainly
rats in cages goes back to the question I asked you a minute ago, which is those laboratory animals don't have control.
They don't have a way to respond
to the situation beyond.
There's no meaning in it. They don't have social support because they tend to be isolated. You know, if you torture rats and you give them social company, you don't see the same kind of stress-related effects that we expect. And I think that points to also a big difference between human experience and some of these laboratory studies, that when you look at human beings, even in extreme circumstances, humans who are able to make meaning out of their suffering, make meaning, not saying that there's meaning sort of intrinsically in the suffering, make meaning, use it as a catalyst for connection, empathy, or helping others. There are a lot of ways, a lot of really natural instincts and capacities that humans have that lab rats don't have that protect us from some of the sort of the horror stories that we hear about how stress can only destroy our well-being.
Well, but you write yourself in The Upside of Stress that you used to, as a health psychologist, tell people about the dangers of stress and how they should reduce it, et cetera.
Yes.
So what changed in your thinking? What changed your mind?
A couple things. So partly because I'm a scientist, I really listen to data. And there were a few studies that started coming out, about 10 years ago, that were really shaking up how researchers were thinking about stress. And I'll tell you about maybe one or two of those. But I want to also mention that the other thing that was happening is I started paying attention to the consequences of telling people who were stressed out how harmful their stressful lives were. And I work as a health psychologist with people who are recovering from trauma, grief, who have experienced chronic stress or really great adversity. And often they can't change the past or they can't change their present circumstances. And to just tell people, your life is toxic. If you had a good life, that would be great for your health. But because you're stressed out, because you're grieving, because you've experienced adversity, you're basically screwed. That was really the message that I had been taught as a health psychologist and was told to share with people as if that would actually help them cope better with the reality of their lives. And when I started paying attention and seeing that actually it was demoralizing, it led to disengagement. People felt less empowered to deal with the reality of their lives. That was the other thing that really gave me the courage to start talking about some of the science, about the upside of stress, about the human capacity for post-traumatic growth and making meaning out of suffering. I don't know if you do you want to hear about any of the studies?
Yeah, I've got lots of questions for you about the studies, but why don't you start by telling us the one or two, if there are one or two you can point
sure.
to that changed your thinking.
Yeah, so one was a study that it was initially conducted by the World Gallup Poll. And they went to people in 121 nations and asked them, did you experience a great deal of stress yesterday? And this was an amazing sample. It represented 98% of the world population. And after the World Gallup Poll conducted that survey, some psychologists got their hands on the data and decided to ask the question, is it good for public health, happiness, the economy, for a nation to have a lot of people saying they're stressed out? They call that the stress index. And what they found was really surprising, that the higher a nation's stress index, the more people who are stressed out every day, the higher the GDP, the greater the life expectancy in that nation, the greater the national happiness, the more satisfied people were with their lives. And when they dug deeper into the data, it seemed as though having a high stress index was also correlated with having a high joy index, a high learning index, a high love index, meaning the things that were giving rise to stress were things like meaningful relationships, parenting. Having a kid under the age of 18 at home was the best predictor of having a lot of stress yesterday, and also saying that you smiled, laughed, or experienced a great deal of love yesterday. And that there seemed to be some really interesting link between meaning, opportunity, and stress. And the happiest people on the planet were the ones who were highly stressed, but not depressed. And this is borne out in a lot of other research, basically linking meaning with stress, that as much as we don't always enjoy the situations that we label stressful, and as much as we often don't like feeling anxious or feeling angry or overwhelmed, that the situations that tend to trigger those feelings are the same relationships or roles or contexts or goals that also give rise to things that we do want, like meaning, learning, love, growth. And I think that was a really important shift for me to recognize that the ideal life is not stress-free. And people who report very low levels of stress are often not happy and frequently depressed.
So that was one study, the Gallup,
mm-hmm.
the Gallup survey.
Yes. And then, so other research that really, you know, blew my mind was the research that started to come out showing that how you think about stress can influence whether or not you experience the negative effects of stress or the positive effects of stress. And one study that I mentioned in my TED Talk that basically scared the pants off me was an epidemiological study that looked at whether having a very stressful life increased your risk of dying, which we've all heard. And they followed 30,000 adults for about a decade. And they found that having a very stressful life only increased the risk of mortality among a small subset of people. Actually, for most people, it didn't increase the risk of death at all. But for people who also, at the beginning of the study, reported that they believed that stress was very harmful for their health. When they thought about the stress in their lives, they viewed that stress as harmful for their health. Those were the folks who showed an increased risk of dying if they had a very stressful life. And the people in the study who didn't view stress as harmful for their health and had very stressful lives were the most likely to be alive at the end of the decade. They were resilient, you know, almost as if they were protected by the stress in their lives. And this study, and it's just a, you know, an epidemiological study. You can't say for sure that thinking stress is bad for you is going to kill you. I don't want to imply that. But it definitely implies that how you think about stress may interact with the stress in your life in a way that either protects you, creates resilience, or increases behaviors and feelings and other factors that increase your risk of experiencing stress-related illness or even mortality. And that was really the beginning of a wave of research on what psychologists call stress mindsets that show that how you think about stress can change everything from what happens in your immune system when you're feeling stressed out to, in the long term, you know, how capable you are of making meaning out of the most stressful circumstances of your life.
I want to remind listeners that you can be part of this conversation with health psychologist Kelly McGonigal by calling us at 410, and I'm looking for the phone number here, 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We'd like you to be part of this conversation also. I want Kelly McGonigal to bore into this idea of mindset, because you spend quite a few pages talking about it in your book, and it frankly almost scared me as you gave examples of the you credit mindset, the way essentially our attitude towards something, as so powerful and actually so manipulable. You gave examples of interventions where a group or an individual might be told to look at something differently than they had been, and that intervention would be having an impact on how they looked at things 20 years later, long after they had forgotten the actual intervention, the actual conversation about changing their mindset. Tell me more about mindset and whether I should be on guard of people trying to surreptitiously change my mindset about things.
Well, you definitely should practice mindset mindfulness, at least being aware of the beliefs we hold that can really influence our well-being. And a mindset is basically, it's not just any old attitude. It's not like, you know, I think that vanilla is better than chocolate. That's an attitude I have. It's not particularly meaningful to my well-being. But a mindset is a belief you hold, often about the way the world works, or about yourself, maybe about other people, that really shapes the way you interpret life's experiences. And the most important mindsets, so the most powerful mindsets, seem to have to do with how people interpret their own negative experiences, whether it's setbacks, you know, whether it's their own, you know, illness, pain, or suffering, that there are certain beliefs we can hold that help us explain and understand why we're experiencing these negative things and what is possible for us to do and how we cope. And there are really interesting studies showing that if you take people who are in difficult life transitions or facing some adversity, and you give them a new way to think about maybe what they're experiencing, that it can transform the trajectory of their success and their happiness over time. Some of my favorite examples of the book of mindsets that help people are when people are told to accept whatever they're struggling with as part of the human experience and not something that reveals how uniquely screwed up they are. You know, so you take, it's back to school time, right? Kids are arriving here on campus at Stanford. If you tell a college freshman, you're going to feel at times maybe like you don't belong here. You might wonder if you're going to be able to graduate, if you can cope. You might have a hard time fitting in. And that's totally normal. That is how most people experience college, and it changes over time, right? You just offer them that perspective, which, by the way, is true, right? Mindsets only help people when they're also true. You don't want to give people sort of false delusions that they to cling to. That's not what this is about. But that actually helps people, make them more likely to achieve higher GPAs, reduces the risk of depression and illness over their college career. It can completely erase what people often expect to be a gap between minority success and non-racial minority success at schools like Stanford. And there are other interventions like this. For example, telling people that people can change over time and to understand that it is possible to change in meaningful ways, that mindset intervention also helps people who are in difficult circumstances, can reduce the risk of depression, can improve physical health and increase personal success. And my sort of curiosity in the last 5 years or so has been, what happens when you tell people that stress isn't necessarily only harmful and toxic? What happens when you tell people the true, you know, findings that stress is part of a meaningful life, that when you're experiencing stress, it is a resource, even though it's often unpleasant and distressing, and that it is possible to transform even the stress you would never choose for yourself. It's possible to transform that into strengthening relationships or growing in meaningful ways, or connecting to a sense of purpose. When you tell people that, does it actually improve their health and well-being? Does it help them cope with stressful circumstances? And the evidence suggests that, yes, that is the case. And that's part of what this book is about trying to help people understand and begin to cultivate this very useful, constructive mindset towards stress.
We've got some callers who want to jump in here. Leonora in Baltimore is a yoga teacher who has a point to make about chronic stress. Leonora, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me. I actually just have a question. I really appreciate this fresh perspective on how we think of stress. And one thing I've often been told is that, and as a, especially as a yoga teacher and learning about occupational therapy, is that we often get caught up in this chronic stress, and they explain it, you know, chronic stress and, you know, the hormones and everything. And I was just curious of your thoughts on that. I'm sure you've heard that argument and how your perspective connects with that common thought.
Kelly,
yeah, absolutely. So one thing that has emerged in the last decade or so of science is that there's a really greater, better understanding of the diversity of stress responses that people can have. And we know that there is a kind of stress response that if you have it chronically, it really is not great for your health and happiness. It changes your DNA in negative ways. It impairs your immune system. All the horrible things that you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, that those things are linked to a particular type of chronic stress response. And it's often characterized in the mind, sort of in your thoughts, as a sense of hostility, a sense of hopelessness, a sense of being overwhelmed by the stress in your life, without being able to find meaning, and also feeling isolated by it, like you're the only one who's struggling or there are people who don't support you. And when you have those sorts of, that sort of relationship to whatever's stressing you out, which can be a very reasonable response to have to some stressful situations, that creates a physical state that is characterized by inflammation and then immune suppression, and, you know, negative changes to cardiovascular health. So that's the kind of thing that Leonora is talking about. And there is evidence that that exists. But we know now that that's not the only kind of stress response that people have, and that there are types of stress responses one might have chronically that actually create resilience and support well-being. So rather than having that kind of fight or flight sort of instinctive survival response that Leonora has heard about, people can have a tend and befriend response, which actually is cardioprotective and healthy for the immune system. That's characterized more by looking for ways to connect with others when you're stressed out, looking for ways to care for others or get the support that you need. And there's a real biological difference in people who have that kind of chronic response to the stress in their lives. People can have a challenge response, which is characterized by, again, different stress hormones that support cardiovascular health and support brain resilience and longevity. And again, you can have that as your chronic sort of default way of responding to stress. And it's not the mere presence of stress in your life that seems to predict whether or not people experience resilience or the harmful outcomes. So I think the most helpful thing is, rather than tell people if you're chronically stressed, you're screwed, which is the basic, you know, explanation most people get, and then telling them they need to avoid stress, which is frankly impossible unless you're willing to disengage from life. Instead of telling people that, I think it's more helpful to have people reflect on their stress response repertoire and are there things they can do to cultivate different ways of responding to stress mentally, socially, psychologically that actually change the physiology of their stress response. And I think yoga is part of that. You know, Leonora mentioned being a yoga instructor. Sometimes people think about yoga as being an opportunity to escape from stress or shut down the stress response. If you actually look at what's happening physiologically when people do yoga, and I know I'm a former yoga researcher and a yoga instructor, that what happens is you actually create a very interesting, healthy stress state in the body. The body's nervous system becomes balanced. It doesn't become relaxed. You have this increase in good stress hormones, a balance of stress hormones. And you're learning how to be present in situations that are often uncomfortable and difficult, you know, like a warrior pose or fierce pose. They aren't comfortable, but you stay mentally present and you stay connected to your purpose and intention for why you're doing the practice. And Leonora probably will appreciate that perspective, that yoga can also be a training ground for getting good at stress rather than escaping or avoiding stress.
Kelly McGonigal, we are going to take a short break here on Midday. I want to thank, we've got quite a few listeners who have called. They called us at 410-662-8780, and you can call too. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Kelly McGonigal, a health psychologist from Stanford University, whose new book is The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Sheila Cast here, sitting in for Dan Rodericks. He'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for making Midday part of your day. We're talking with Kelly McGonigal, a psychologist from Stanford University. Her new book is The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. This goes against most of the medical advice we get about avoiding stress or getting rid of stress. It requires changing how we feel about stress. We've got several callers, and I'm glad you called, and I'm suggesting others call too at 410-662-8780. I will get to you, but I do want to raise this because, Kelly McGonigal, you cite lots of studies that make different parts of your case about why stress can be good for us and how we can harness it. Just last week, the New York Times printed a fairly damning story reporting that a team of volunteer psychologists attempted to replicate 100 mm-hmm. major studies. You read this. 100 major studies published in top psychological journals. And two-thirds of the time, they could not replicate the results. They came up with the same results as the original study, only one-third of the time. What does that say about the state of this science, and why should we believe the studies that you cite any more than these studies that could not be replicated?
I love that you bring this up. So this is a really important project that's going on in psychological science right now, where people, there's a big movement in psychology to try to increase the quality, the validity, and the replicability of studies. And this report that you described, one thing that's important to mention is it's not that two-thirds of the studies were contradicted or sort of proven false. It was that they couldn't replicate the same effect size. So many of these studies, they found results that were in the same direction as the initial studies, but they didn't have as large an effect. And I think that's very different than some people have been talking about it, as if they sort of conclusively proved that two-thirds of the initial findings or results were wrong, or they found findings going in the opposite direction. And that was not the case. But I think that so the bigger issue that this raises is one should never pin one's hope on a single scientific study. That one of the things that I tried to do with this book, and I try to do as a teacher, is have people start to create a sort of a felt sense for the accumulation of evidence and then become their own experimenter or psychologist, you know, scientist in their own lives, because you need to test through direct evidence whether something helps you or not. And even in studies that have enormous effect sizes and they're replicated over and over again, in any given study, there are going to be people for whom the opposite of the core finding was true. That's because humans have tremendous variation. And so anytime you hear a finding that says something like, the best way to deal with stress is X, or, you know, the way to improve your happiness is Y, you should think, well, you know, how is that consistent with my direct experience? What happens if I try it out? And in the book, I offer all of these basically stress experiments, mindset experiments that you can try and see. Does this help you cope better at work? Like, what happens when you are dealing with work stress and you tell yourself, okay, I can handle this. I have the resources to handle this. And my pounding heart is a sign that my heart is in it. I care and my body is giving me energy. And then just test that out, because there's a lot of evidence, many studies suggesting that that actually helps people do better. It helps people connect with others better. It's good for their physical health. But you got to try it in your own life and see if it works. And I think that this replicability project in psychology, it's sort of consistent with that idea that one should never take, you know, at sort of face value any finding that someone else delivers to you, that the only way to really improve your own health and happiness and well-being is to be willing to be an experimenter in your own life and listen to your own data, right? And I think that that's part of one of the things that really encouraged me to take this big risk. This has been a big professional risk to start to even talk about the science that suggests that embracing stress can be helpful, because there's evidence on both sides. But it's been my direct experience working with people who are suffering or even just dealing with ordinary everyday stress that this mindset really does support well-being and support strength in difficult times.
We have a couple of listeners who are particularly interested in how this connects with children. Jean wrote us, can children and adolescents be taught to use stress to their benefit? It seems so hard for them to look beyond what is immediately stressing them. And before I let you answer that, let me bring Ned onto the line. Ned in Pasadena also has a thought about stress and children. Ned?
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm interested in knowing how to teach children to handle stress without lashing out or spitting and hitting. And can your guest suggest titles that deal with this, but that don't propose the use of punishments by the parent or adult onto the child when the child reacts badly to stress, you know, and shrieks and spits and so on and so forth?
Kelly McGonigal?
Yeah, so many interesting questions raised by both Jean and Ned. I'll start and pull me back on track if it feels like I've gotten too far away from this.
Okay.
But I think one of the most important things to understand about the science of stress and kids' well-being is this new understanding that experiencing stress is really important for kids to develop happiness, success, resilience, empathy, that experiencing a certain amount of stress is really important. And parenting strategies that focus on trying to protect kids from all stress are likely to backfire by maybe protecting them from good stress or meaningful stress without being able to actually protect them from the worst kinds of stress. You know, you can't protect kids from losing a loved one or experiencing, you know, their own health problems, but you could protect them from the meaningful stress of trying to reach difficult goals and experiencing failure. So I think that that sort of as a parenting strategy is being strongly challenged by the research, the idea that we should be trying to help kids avoid stress as opposed to giving them stressful experiences that are connected to meaning in some way or to growth in some way. And in terms of helping kids develop that resilience, so what do you do when the kid has a difficult emotion, they're angry, they're frustrated, or they're really upset or sad? I really like the approaches that are being offered that look at mindfulness as a resource for dealing with stress, and not mindfulness in sort of the simplistic model of, well, we all need to calm down and take deep breaths. And we, you know, like not that sort of mindfulness, but the mindfulness that says, okay, notice what you're feeling in your body right now. Like, what does this anger feel like? You'd be surprised how young kids can be and do this sort of exercise and be able to label their emotions. We know that when kids are able to label what they're feeling, it actually automatically begins to increase their control over those emotions, gives them some flexibility. And kids can do this quite young. Parents can focus kids' attention on the meaning of the stress rather than immediately trying to distract or soothe them. So, you know, I bet you really care about this. You know, I can tell how much this meant to you. I can tell how much this friendship means to you. To actually put into words the kind of inner dialogue that we actually hope kids and adolescents will develop over time. So when they're feeling their feelings are hurt or they're frustrated, instead of the inner dialogue that often develops like, well, you know, forget this. I don't care about this. I don't care about you. To try to protect themselves from the feelings, they might actually have an inner reflection of, yeah, I feel this way because I really care and this relationship matters to me, or this project or this goal matters to me. And I think the other thing that parents can do, in addition to helping kids label their feelings, to acknowledge the meaning connected to whatever's causing the stress, is parents need to get really comfortable with kids who are stressed out. That the more parents feel like they need to fix the stress, that they need to calm the kid down immediately or distract them or bribe them or punish them to get them to stop. The more they try to control the kid's experience of stress, the more the kid learns it's not okay to be stressed. And then they start turning to their own solutions. And at the college level, you see this. That's what binge drinking is for many kids. It's what they've learned is it's not okay to feel stressed out or anxious. So I'm going to drink it out. I'm going to drink it away. And a lot of the behaviors that we actually try to protect our kids from that are destructive or addictive are actually behaviors that people are engaging in because what they've learned growing up is that they can't handle stress and they should be doing things to try to basically escape it.
You're listening to Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan Rodericks, and we're talking to Kelly McGonigal about her new book, The Upside of Stress, Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. You can be part of the conversation if you give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wipr.org. Dory in Annapolis has been holding a while. Dory? What do you want to add?
Good afternoon. Just a quick question. When it seems as though when people are diagnosed with cancer, the immediate response by everyone, it seems, feels you get rid of all the stress in your life. Mm. And in many ways, you have answered the question, Kelly, but I just wondered if you could fill in more, you know, how do you deal with that when it seems as though the whole world is... is thinking
it's exactly the time you're feeling most stress.
Right.
Yes.
And people are saying, get rid of it.
I know. And, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions people have, by the way, is that stress causes cancer. And there is so much evidence that that is not the case with human cancer. And that's, I think, part of what's behind when people say you need to get rid of the stress in your life right now. If you're stressed, if you're worried about it, you need to have a positive attitude. That's not what I'm talking about when I'm talking about embracing stress. It's not this sort of militant positive thinking or your negative thoughts are going to kill you. That's sort of an exaggeration, but I think that's a lot of times people who are dealing with health crises, they feel that. That is what is being told to them. And then they start to fear their own thoughts and their own emotions and the reality of their stressful lives. And so I think it's really important to know, first of all, that stress is highly unlikely to be the cause of cancer. And people who are going through any sort of health crisis do not need to be told that they're sort of now they also have the job of managing, avoiding, or reducing stress in what is probably the most stressful, you know, experience of their lives. And instead, what seems to really help people who are going through a health crisis or caring for a loved one who's going through a health crisis is to find a way to balance, to acknowledge the reality of the suffering and the difficulties. So you always want to give people room to talk about the stress, talk about the fears, talk about physical pain and discomfort. That's part of embracing stress, is to understand that we need to acknowledge the reality of pain and suffering in people's lives, and that even just acknowledging it rather than wanting to turn away from it, run away from it, distract ourselves from it, that just accepting attitude is part of the mindset that helps people deal better. And in addition to that, there also studies show that when people are also invited to think of ways to use this as an opportunity to connect with others, to try to find sort of focus on their values, their priorities, to let this health crisis be a catalyst for making changes or focusing on what matters, that is sort of the other side that really helps people maintain resilience during health crises.
This our time with you has just sped by. We're down to just a minute, Kelly. So I guess all I have time to do is to thank you on behalf of listeners, including some listeners who are still holding here to talk to you. Kelly McDonald's book is The Upside of Stress: Why Stress is Good for You and How to Get Good at It. Thank you. It's an imprint of Avery Publishing, right? An imprint of Random House.
Yes.
Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Take care. Tomorrow, Dan will be back. He'll talk about the results of today's hearing on motions in the Freddie Gray murder case. So we hope you'll join us again on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass sitting in for Dan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.